into sports.
20 yards out, Urs to shoot, don't shoot! Oh, what a goal from Fabinho! Wow!
Then get into the all-new OTB Sports app.
I think when he apologises to me, I probably will say hello to him, yeah. No, I'm...
Videos, sports news, live scores, interviews.
If Fabregas is going to come up to me in the street and give me some of the mouth that he would have given me on a football pitch, what would he do? He'd get a slap.
Plus, exclusive content on the OTB Podcast Network. The biggest names in sports. Ready when you are. Search OTB Sports on your app store and download it now.
The OTB Podcast Network. With Green Farm on the go. Snack smart with 100% natural, protein-powered chicken bites.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, fueling the mischief in the beautiful game. Gamble responsibly. See dunlewy.net.
Now you're welcome along to the football show. Later on, we'll talk to Adam Pope of BBC Leeds about their roller coaster month. First up, though, Damien Delaney is going to join us. Latest in the Premier League: Fulham 1, Manchester United 1. It's just gone half time. Ademola Lookman put Fulham 1-0 up after just 5 minutes. Wan-Bissaka played him onside on the other side of the pitch, so Lookman had all the time he needed to put the ball into the net. And then on 21 minutes, Fulham keeper made a mess of things. Cavani was there in the box to finish. So half-time and it's 1-0. Earlier on, Aston Villa really good against Man City for a huge part of the game, but ultimately Man City quality came through and they scored in the 79th. And 90th minutes. It was Bernardo Silva on 79 minutes and Gundogan in the 90th minute with a penalty. So Man City go top of the league and Manchester United looking to reclaim top this evening is where we are. Damien Delaney, evening, how you doing?
Hi Joe, how are you?
Good form. Watching any of the football this evening?
Watching all of it. Sat down there at 6 o'clock and really enjoyed the Man City game. It was a cracker of a game. Two teams going right at it. Aston Villa were fantastic, you know, a little bit on the counter attack, but it had their share of the game as well. I thought Man City were very, very good. I mean, they missed a hatful of chances, and as you get into like 80 minutes, you might think it's going to be one of those nights. But they got a fortuitous or dubious or controversial goal, whichever one you want to say, with an offside decision. I think they were even delving into the rules of the game and the lettering of or the wording of a certain law with the offside, which I didn't know personally, to be honest. I thought it was offside. I still think it should have been offside, but they kind of confidently told us that by the wording in it that it was quite correct, the decision.
So what happened exactly?
So basically, Man City had a ball over the top and Martin is a goalkeeper. I won't say shanked one, but he wasn't the best of clearances to the halfway line. And I think it was Rodri headed it. Now, obviously, the ball was played over the top to Man City player. It might have been Rodri that was coming back, actually. Sorry, I'm right. So it was headed it. So Rodri had kind of chased down the long ball. As the ball was cleared, he's 25, 30 yards offside, but Gundogan's headed it straight to Tyrone Mings, who's had a touch, tried then to turn, but seemed to turn back into a kind of a Rodri, who was kind of getting back onside. Rodri nicked it off and played it to Bernardo Silva, who shifted it and put it in the top corner. But I was kind of the understanding that, you know, if you're coming back from an offside position and then you kind of get involved in a game, that you are alive. But Peter Walton was on BT there and he said that once Mings tried to make a play on the ball and once he had it under control, then it's kind of a new phase of play and Rodri is no longer deemed offside.
Ah, geez, that's new on me. That's tough to designate a new phase of play as soon as Mings takes a touch.
You know what was really strange though is that VAR never even looked at it. It was always just given straight away as a goal and actually Dean Smith got sent off for his protestations of it. And it never went to VAR. There was never a VAR check. So unless the referees knew the law, which obviously they did, but I mean the extreme wording of the law that once he makes a deliberate play, that's the word, a deliberate play on the ball, which Tyrone Mings did. Mm. Now, it's not as if Rodri was coming back from, you know, at an angle. He was coming back directly behind him. And as he took it, controlled it on his chest and touched it to his right, Rodri's just nicked it off him. And kind of everyone kind of stopped thinking, surely that's offside. I mean, I've never seen that not given, to be honest with you. But it was given very, very quickly by the officials.
Oh, that's crazy. I mean, it shouldn't be designated a new phase of play until Mings has maybe passed the ball or dribbled a certain amount forward. That is still very much in that same passage of play when the ball has been
absolutely
headed to Mings.
Absolutely. And I'm pretty sure that he took it on his chest thinking that Rodri can't get me with this because he's coming back from an offside position. So he's took kind of the touch to the side almost as if it's a free play. I don't think it is, but the very fact that VAR didn't look at it, the referees didn't take a minute just to consult with each other and say, are we correct in saying this? Yes, we are. The goal was given and nothing happened. It was only about 5 minutes later they showed the replay and obviously then Peter Walton came in and gave the official. Actually, at the time, Peter Walton said that should have been offside during the game when he came on air. He said, that's offside. Mm-hmm. It was only afterwards when he read up on it. He went, oh, actually, that's onside. Very, very dubious, wow. You know what I mean? I don't want to start levelling accusations at very strange.
Yeah. I'm going to go to Craven Cottage. The halftime report is in. This is Manchester City against Aston Villa. Joe Rawson's watched that first half.
Half-time, Fulham 1, Manchester United 1. It was a sluggish start from Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's side, who were behind after just 5 minutes. Ademola Lookman beat the offside trap to latch onto a through ball played by Anguissa and finish well into the bottom corner. But United responded well. Edinson Cavani grabbing the equaliser after a mistake from Alphonse Areola, the Fulham goalkeeper, who spilled Fernandez's cross straight to Cavani, who couldn't miss. Fernandez has also hit the post, while Harry Maguire should have done better when he was found from a corner, but he missed the target with a free header. Fulham still look dangerous on the break. Good game this. United have work to do to finish the evening at the top of the table. Half-time, Fulham 1, Manchester United 1.
Yeah, it is a good game. It is a good game. We are going to take a very short break and just try and get Damien's line sorted out. As you can hear, it's okay, but just going in and out. The joys of Zoom and Skype in 2020/2021. So we'll take a short break and hopefully have Damien on a good line on the way back.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. Fueling the mischief in the beautiful game. Gamble responsibly. See dunlewy.net.
Welcome back. So hopefully Damien Delaney back with us. You're there? This is tense. Damien Delaney, hello.
Yeah, I'm here. Sorry, man. The kettle just boiled, Joe. Sorry.
Oh, no worries. It's just live radio. I'll fill time.
Sorry, man. Sorry.
To finish up on your point, it sounds then like, weirdly, both Man City and Villa come away with a good bit of credit from that game.
Yeah, very good. I think Villa could be very, very proud of the way they played. They were really, really good. They were front foot when they had to be. They were nice and solid when they had to be. They're in a really good place at the minute, Villa. A good spirit about them, a good feel about them. Obviously, I don't believe I won't say it ever, but they shouldn't be in any relegation trouble this season, barring a complete collapse in the second half. And they can actually start looking up the table now, you know, and maybe they can get one or two signings in January and really start getting up the table.
Yeah, it's a hell of a turnaround from last season. So 11th in the table, going along very nicely. Conor Hourihan's moved on, actually, in the last couple of days. We've seen that on loan to Swansea. Just on loan, obviously, he wants minutes. He wants to be part of Stephen Kenny's plans. Is Hourihan good enough to nail down pretty much week in, week out? Is he good enough to nail down a starting berth in that Villa side?
Probably not, no. But I think he should be commended for going out on loan as quickly as what he has. You know, I think last year he got an awful lot of minutes. Even at the beginning of this year, he got an awful lot of minutes as well. But when you look at the midfielders, having watched Villa a little bit this year, you know, he always seemed to be fourth choice out of the three. You know, there always seemed to be three ahead of him. It wasn't necessarily always the same three, but he was always the one that was on the bench. And I think the last couple of months, with him not being involved, he should be commended for obviously knocking on the manager's door and saying, look, I want to go and play football. I'm a football player. And if it means I need to drop back into the Championship and play some games, because maybe he's, you know, concerned about his international career. But I think it's a great thing for him. You know, there's no point in him just sitting around on the bench till the end of the season and then having that conversation with the manager. I'm pretty sure that a few weeks ago, him and the manager agreed that it'd be best for him to go and play football.
Okay. I don't know, did you watch the first 45 from Craven Cottage? We're not going to have an Ole Gunnar Solskjaer discussion, by the way. This day last week, everything we said still stands pretty much. United in that first 45, I mentioned there when we were reconnecting with you, Rio Ferdinand's done seriously, I think, you know, good piece of analysis pointing out how Baye just did not read the danger, did not see the situation. And ultimately, like, I never thought he should be in that United team. And that ultimately is the reason why the decision-making at times is not trustworthy.
Like, I mean, look, man, you know, Aaron Wan-Bissaka is the one that played him on side, but if you, it is Paul Pogba ends up tracking, and Pogba does great to see it. Now he can't get there, but because Baye's not slid across, there's a 25-yard gap appeared between the two centre backs, and Paul Pogba actually goes in between the two centre backs, and Baye kind of steps up the last minute because he realises he's in a terrible position, and he kind of thinks, well, the only card I've got left to play is to step up, which then makes it look really like Aaron Wan-Bissaka switched off. But look, Man United were very, very poor for opening 15, 20 minutes. And I mean, very, very poor. Wan-Bissaka had an atrocious first 10 minutes of the game. And a few others did as well, to be honest with you. But they got it going eventually there, the back end of the first half, sorry. And they were in the ascendancy. Fernandes came into the game an awful lot more. But again, you know, I remember last week we spoke, you know, United don't start games reasonably well. They don't kind of stamp their authority on the games. And it's not just every now and again. It's nearly every game, even the Burnley game last week when we spoke. It was very, very similar, you know, and they got caught out tonight. But look, they seem to be getting into a good rhythm at the minute. And I think they should go on and win that game in the second half.
I want to talk to you about Chelsea then, because it's getting serious now for Lampard, it would seem. They're eighth, you know, like it's an amazing drop off from where they were. They're eighth after 19 games, a 2-0 defeat last night at the King Power Stadium. This is a sixth defeat of the season, fifth loss in eight games. Lots of outlets today reporting that this is the end for Lampard now, like The Athletic are saying there's a sense of finality around the club. It's starting to look, I mean, yeah, geez, it's still early days to pull the trigger on a manager, but it's starting to look like he's running out of ideas, and this is not the most patient owner, even for his favourite son.
Yeah, I think he's under an enormous amount of pressure, and I think rightly so. You know, last year he got a lot of breaks, he got an awful lot of breathing room with the transfer embargo they had, and Eden Hazard leaving. And he'd done a terrific job last year to get fourth. But, you know, I did say at the start of the season that, you know, all these players brings an added amount of pressure and an added amount of expectancy. And it is a big issue, gelling all the players. But I don't believe that Frank Lampard should be given like a free reign to do as he pleases. You know, the players he was handed, there will be an expectancy, and rightly so. And he should be getting better results than what he had. I think the only thing going from is, you know, he started the season really, really well, you know, especially when Mendy came in after a couple of games, and they breezed through their Champions League group, and they were really, really good. I mean, you know, we're 19 games in now, and I would say 6 to 8 games, Chelsea have been pretty average, to be honest with you. So whether or not he'll get the bullet really, really soon, I don't know. He might get another couple of games, or he might get another few weeks. But I don't feel sorry for him in any way, you know. But I suppose what you said there, Joe, is quite correct, that it looks like he's running out of ideas. And I'd say that when, you know, they were doing so well, and then the couple of games, rocky patch, he's probably lost his head. He's probably put his hand around him. He's probably been Mr. Nice Guy. He's probably been everything he can be. And I think that's where a real experienced manager comes into play, that when you do hit a rocky patch, that there's a consistency in his behaviour, there's a consistency in his demeanour. He does it, you know, hit the roof some weeks and then come in and be your best friend the next day. You know, I always feel the best managers that I play for, you know, no matter what happened, and I believe Roy Hodgson was the best person at it, my last manager I played for, is that, like, no matter what happens, he always stood there like he knew that was going to happen. And he's got a plan to fix it. Now, inside, he might be doing somersaults and might be absolutely panicking as much as we are, but he doesn't show it to the players. You know, when he comes in on a Monday morning, and he always seemed to handle it correctly after a bad defeat, or if we were on a good run or a bad run, he always seemed to gauge the mood of the changing room and be spot on the money. But that's experience. Roy Hodgson's in his 70s. Frank's in his second job. Now, it is a colossal job for him to take in such a short managerial spell. And it's going to be a test for him. I did read somewhere as well that Avram Grant was, you know, there was talk of him coming in as kind of Frank's, I won't say mentor, but, you know, kind of someone, a bounce board for Frank, or somebody he can talk to, which really is last chance saloon, to be honest with you. And that really is the owner giving him every opportunity to keep his job. So it'll be interesting, but I don't have any sympathy for him. He knew the rules of the game. He took the job. He got all these players in the summer. He knew what was expected of him. And Chelsea's a club that is based on winning. And if you spend that much money and you are in eighth position and performances are as bad as what they are, then, you know, your neck should be on the block.
Last night he had Mason Mount as one of the deeper midfielders and Kovacic was in and he took out Jorginho and he put in Kai Havertz, one of his big new signings, into, I guess, one of the more forward roles in that initial three. And then the front three was Hudson-Odoi, Tammy Abraham, Pulisic. So Jorginho was on the bench, Timo Werner was on the bench, Ziyech was on the bench as well. The thing with this team at the moment and for quite some time now is those six players, those three midfielders, three forwardish players, really, I wouldn't think there's been a game where anyone's been able to predict the team. And there's chopping and changing and there's squad rotation and then there's just searching for something, you know?
Absolutely.
And he just hasn't cracked a combination. Is there a combination there that works where he can somehow work, and stay with me here? You think he wants Mount in the team. You feel like Ziyech's talent is fairly awesome if you can fit him in, and he'll be under a degree of pressure to have Werner and Havertz in the team, and there doesn't seem to be an obvious balance there. You feel like Pulisic has to play as well. There's just no secret sauce to get all this to work at the moment.
But that's what an experienced manager does. He finds that in kind of way of gelling it all together, and then the players that aren't in the team, he finds a way of managing them and keeping them kind of in tune and keeping them focused and keeping them right on the boil, so that if one of the other players drops out or he wants to try a different system or he wants to go another way, they come in and they're really, really happy. But at the minute, he's just bouncing, and as you said, the word you're looking for there, you use it, is searching. I'd nearly go so far as the word scrapping.
Yeah, no, it does feel, it feels fairly manic. It's like, okay, you're out, you're in, you're out, you're in. We'll try this. And he's hoping that someday there's going to be a beautiful performance and he can go, okay, that's the guts of my six. Do you see an obvious, to put you on the spot, because, and it's a tough question, you're not working with these players every day and all the rest of it, but do you see an obvious way you can get, you know, those big signings into the team, he wants Mount on the team, and be defensively solid as well?
I think the first thing he needs to do is he would have had this because he would have spoke about it with Chelsea before he got the job, is what's his identity? What does he want to do as a manager? What's he trying to achieve? And then he picks the best players that fit that. But then you manage the other ones. And if it means Kai Havertz sits on the bench or Timo Werner or one of the main men sits on the bench and you stay true to your principles, but it just seems that his principles have just got a little bit rattled, and that's pressure. You know, when you hit a couple of bad results, you lose focus, and that's why maybe an Avram Grant that will come in and Frank can vent to him, and Avram can say, look, take a deep breath, you know, write down what you're looking for, write down what your beliefs, your principles are, and let's pick a team that will go and get us that, and then be consistent on the training ground. Because believe me, players can spot when a manager is panicking. Even if he's not doing it like openly ranting and raving, if his training sessions are just one week he's doing this, the next week he's doing that. I've had managers that are doing that. You can see the pressure's got to them. One week they're playing 3-5-2, the next week they're playing 4-5-1, and the players don't know whether they're coming or going. And it just seems that it's gone a little bit that way for Frank. But he just needs to ground himself really, really quickly, figure out his best team and just stick with it. And really work on that, and then just deal with the fallout of the superstars that are on the bench.
Yeah. Like, Spurs aren't perfect, but you knew Mourinho was starting to improve things there when you could start to predict that team, you know, when it takes on that shape. Yep. So a few of the reports today, it was in that piece in The Athletic, for instance, says that at the club, they're looking at the likes of Nagelsmann, Tuchel, Hasenhüttl. Their thinking is they want some Bundesliga experience. They want a German-speaking manager because of Havertz and because of Timo Werner.
That's crazy.
I know. He's like, this is the level of...
That's not true. That can't be true either.
They've spent all this money on these German lads. Let's get in a German.
That's crazy. I tell you what, right, we can come back to that. But I believe, in my personal opinion, it's a race between Manchester United and Chelsea now to who can get Brendan Rodgers. I'm just throwing that out there.
Chelsea are going to win.
I think Chelsea will too, because Manchester United are limping along enough that they won't sack their manager, whereas Chelsea have hit rock bottom quicker, just like PSG hit rock bottom and took Pochettino.
I can't believe Brendan Rodgers is the new Pochettino.
Listen, I'm telling you, you got to give that man credit for what he's done. You know,
incredible.
Whether you like his personality or not.
I don't mind his personality. Genuinely, I get the gripes with him, but I think the last year or two he's been fine. No,
he's drifted from the old the David Brent type comments that he used to come out with. He really has, and he's kind of, you know, when he left Liverpool, everyone thought that was going to be it for him. That everyone thought he was overachieving in that job and going up to Celtic. But I tell you, he's done a fabulous job at Celtic, and he came down to Leicester and he's put them in an unbelievable position. The guy is clearly an extremely good manager. Yeah. Players always, I've never heard any player say anything bad about Brendan Rodgers ever. Whether, you know, they left the club, they were still at the club, or they moved on or whatting. You know, he treats players really, really well. Listening to Madison's interview last night, tactically the guy is so astute. Obviously with him managing Liverpool, the United job might be a difficult one for him, but he's got to be the next name at the top of the list for me. I mean, Chelsea don't really need to take the risk of going with a German manager that might take time to settle. Is he going to improve results massively in his first year in the Bundesliga? Coming from the Bundesliga to the Premier League, maybe they'll take some time to settle. I just think with Brendan Rodgers, you've got a fantastic ready-made replacement for Frank if they decide to go that way.
And apparently he coached Roman Abramovich's son at football when he was at the club, so there's a link there.
I can't believe that. I think Frank Lampard is in the situation now that the club are actively sounding out other people just in case.
Rodgers, I mean, things are going so well at Leicester. He's in a great place. Like, you put a foot wrong at Chelsea for 2 months, you get the sack, and he's already had the Celtic fans going, "Oh, who do you think you are leaving us to go for Leicester? Who are Leicester?" Now he's going to upgrade again, and I mean, he has to take it, doesn't he? If Chelsea come, he has to take it.
He's got history at that club as well. You know, he was, you know, under schoolboy manager, right? Jose brought him through and stuff. So he knows the club really, really well. He will have a good relationship with nearly everybody at the club. So I think it's a race between those two together. Right.
He'll probably do well, Rodgers. You know, he probably will.
I think so. He's experienced. I mean, you know, the Liverpool thing probably could have killed off a lot of people, you know, with his experience there, you know, missing out on the league and then it falling apart. But he went to Glasgow and rebuilt himself. And he's doing a fabulous job at Leicester now, really.
Mm. And it's a look, based on 2016, amongst many other things, this is a stupid thing to say, but he's really flavour of the month now at Leicester. Yeah. Like, how much better can it get?
Being favoured a month at Chelsea would be a hell of a lot better.
That's what I mean. Like, if he's to turn down Chelsea, the ceiling with Leicester has got to be approaching pretty soon.
Listen, I think they could get Champions League this year. Absolutely. Are they going to win the league? I doubt it, to be honest with you. Is he ever going to get the serious backing to get to the latter stages of the Champions League? Because he's obviously very, very ambitious in himself, and I think that's the reason he left Celtic. You know, I think he wanted to sign players because he realised that it was getting harder and harder to get out of the qualification groups just to get into the Champions League. And obviously Celtic were of the opinion that, you know, well, you know, Rangers aren't an entity anymore, so why would we want to spend all this money, you know, on just the Champions League when we can just keep, you know, winning the league here and doing really, really well? And I think that's the reason he left, because he wanted those big European nights, and I'm pretty sure he'll want them at Leicester too. But I mean, European nights at Chelsea would be, I think, the pinnacle for him.
Yeah. Where Lampard would pitch up with his next job is interesting. Still great profile, all the rest of it. But I mean, could be bottom half Premier League territory, maybe even a bit lower.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think maybe he might have to go and gain that experience that perhaps he's missing in these moments at Chelsea. You know, when you come out of playing and you go straight into a changing room, you have your ideas. They're all great. But, you know, it's like that old Mike Tyson saying, you know, everyone's got a plan until they get punched in the face. Yeah. And I think that's what he's feeling at the minute at Chelsea.
Power of the pundit here. This is the power you possess in your punditry. So James Maddison has scored in 3 games in a row now, and he was this is the first time in his career he scored 3 Premier League goals in a row, and he says it's down to Jamie Carragher. So he was watching the match back against Sheffield United, he was watching the game, Jamie Carragher's in commentary, and he says, Maddison there, if he's going to play for England, he needs to get his numbers up and score more goals. And Maddison thought, that's a good idea. Like this, I mean, maybe it hadn't occurred to him before. I don't know, but he says
that's what that he needed. Like, I mean, that's
scoring goals, good. Yeah. Me, he says, me, the gaffer, Jack, the analyst, and he says Jack will be buzzing. I've name dropped him, which was kind of funny. We looked at where I could get more goals, and he said it's little things. I break from deeper now, which is kind of an interesting point, and then get it beyond that last line, almost smelling where the ball is going to go. It's not an easy thing to do, but I've worked on it. So. kind of interesting. They've worked on it and it's paid off, and he's seeking it out. But Jamie Carragher saying score more goals did the trick.
That's the interesting part, that he's dropped Jamie Carragher's name, and that he needs to be told that scoring more goals, and maybe something that maybe the coaching staff at Leicester might have said to him, yeah. Or maybe Jack the analyst might have like prepared something for him and given it to him. So, but look, it doesn't matter. I'm sure it was a bit tongue in cheek that, yeah. But it was fantastic that he has done that, you know.
Mm. Dan and I were touching on Rooney's playing career last night. I know you did touch on this on Saturday, so I won't dwell on the point. But I was just curious. We probably fell into that broad enough consensus, the gist of which, you know, to various degrees or other, you think Rooney's been an amazing player for sure, and like top goal scorer for United, top goal scorer for England. It's really churlish to criticise that, and yet there's a but, you know, and there's a sense that he was so phenomenal that you thought he might kick on to even greater heights. And there's the Ronaldo parallel the whole time, which is probably unfair in him. So you've come up against him. You saw the finished product. You know just how good he was to play against.
He had first of all, I do disagree with what you're saying there. I think he's every bit as good as his numbers suggest. I think that in any other country, maybe in time, they'd be putting up statues of him. You know, he's that good. He was unbelievable for England. His appetite for football was insane. And the number of times that I came up against him, his intensity, his desire, his will. I mean, the way he carried himself on the pitch just was like, I'm not losing today. And I suppose my takeaway from the 2016 FA Cup final when we played against United and he was captain, we scored in the 79th or 80th minute. And one thing that I noticed during the game was, and this was in Van Gaal's tenure when Rooney was kind of converted to a number six or a central midfield player, he just kind of took the game by the scruff of the neck, and he just went and got the ball, and he just started spraying balls over my head, over every, like in behind us, switching the play. It was almost like, you know, when the goal went in, he just went, right, I'm having this. I'm not losing this game today. And he just went and grabbed the game by the scruff of the neck, and nobody could stop him because he was like a man possessed. That genuinely is my takeaway from that game, of how good he was. And I think they're the things that maybe it's hard to quantify. You know, his numbers are great, and maybe you can say that he didn't reach the heights of Ronaldo, but he was such a team player. He never complained, would play anywhere, wanted to play football, but I think the guy was just an out-and-out winner. He had a desire probably that I've only seen matched by maybe Luis Suarez, you know, when you played against him. He had a similar type of, like, strut to him where it was just like, I'm going to kill anyone that's getting in my way today. I want to win, and I don't care how I do it. And I suppose they are things that are hard to quantify. But yeah, for me, I think he's every bit as good as his numbers suggest.
Mm. Yeah, that's a really interesting take, because even 2016, that'd be an era when, from the sidelines, you'd say, well, Rooney was very much in the decline, and yet you describe him almost like force nature.
Yeah, he was. And then there was a couple of times when we first went up 2013-14 where he was playing centre forward, like, and he was just so clever. He was so good technically as well. He kept going short, and I didn't know whether to stick or twist. And when you did one, he got you with the other. And he really was, you know, he never seemed to take a minute off in a game. He was just always like in tune with the game and thinking, what can I do to help us win this game of football? And I suppose that's just something that you kind of just see when you play against him or see him close up. Mm. But I've got a huge amount of respect for him, you know, really do.
Oh, of course. I mean, you couldn't but. And ultimately, we conclude the chat by saying, look, he was phenomenally good. He did incredibly well. And you are being a bit churlish to kind of nitpick or pick holes or wonder, did he get the most out of his talent? Do you see where people are coming from with that, because it's a fairly commonly held critique of Rooney that there might have been more there.
But he was never a Messi or a Ronaldo or a Neymar. You know, he wasn't that type of guy. He was from the streets, you know. He was just a guy who just showed up and just wanted to win. Real old-fashioned type of player. There was never any, I'd say, glitz or glamour about him. You know, he was the ultimate team player. Yeah. And if he had to lay his body on the line or play in a wide area to accommodate someone else, he did it, but he did it to the best of his ability. And I suppose he brought something to Manchester United, which was the will and the mentality, because you can say, oh, we can get a better right winger than him, but you're not going to get a better personality than him. And, you know, his personality will go an awful long way in Manchester United's kind of fabric of winning. Mm. And I feel that that's what he brought to the club more so than, you know, highlight reels and, you know, squeaky clean behaviour and advertising and stuff like that. He wasn't. He definitely wasn't. I don't think he ever claimed to be. He was a bit, as I said, a bit raw and from the streets, you know, but that's the type of guy he was, and he made more than the most of his talents.
Yeah, I think that's a really well made point. Good stuff. I'm glad I asked you about that now, because I was thinking, were we a bit touch harsh on him last night? But that's very well said. Listen, I'll talk to you when I talk to you. Thanks so much.
All right, Joe, good talk to you.
See you. Damien Delaney there. They're back underway at Craven Cottage, an hour on the clock. This one kicked off at 8:15, so slightly later finish than usual. So an hour gone, and still Fulham 1, Manchester United 1. We're checking in on Leeds next.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power, fueling the mischief in the beautiful game. Gamble responsibly, see dunlewy.net.
Now you're welcome back. Always good to have Adam Pope of BBC Leeds with us. Adam, great to have you back on the show. How are things?
Hey, thanks, Joe. Okay, thank you. Not so great with Leeds at the moment, but hey, in the overall picture, okay.
But not dull is the point. Not dull, you know, and there's a lot of people who support dull teams. Can I throw some numbers at you and you can just give me a sense of just how mad this all is? So they're currently 12th on the table. That's got to be acceptable, bottom line, and that's the ultimate point. But for instance, goals scored, they're 30 goals scored, which is 6th in the table. Goals conceded, 34, 2nd in the table. Shots, 266, that's them 2nd highest in the table. Shots against, 259, that's them 2nd in the table. And then some of the scorelines of the last while. They whooped Newcastle 5-2. They go to Old Trafford, lose 6-2. That was an unbelievable game. They beat Burnley 1-0, positively boring by their standards, Adam. Then they beat West Brom 5-0, then Spurs come and beat them 3-0, then Crawley Bloody Town from League 2 beat them 3-0, and then just the other night, Brighton beat them 1-0, and Bielsa said that the last two games have concerned him slightly. But I mean, like, I'm throwing all them numbers up in the air and I'm saying it's good fun altogether. So what's the feeling then?
Yeah, I mean, the feeling's one of concern at the moment, because I think it's no goals since the turn of the year, Joe. And the big thing about that is that there's been a distinct lack of chances created. In the past with Bielsa's side, it's more of a case of chances created, chances missed. But notably, there's been very few shots on target. I mean, I'm just thinking last time out, hardly was the keeper tested at all. And on top of that, there weren't many great chances created either. So that game was for me a big one. I think if they'd won that would definitely guarantee them for me in the another year in the Premier League, which I think is going to happen. But there is concern, Joe, because far from it going off the rails, it's just that there's that awful feeling that you get, and it's annually with Leeds now, is that they go out of the FA Cup to lower league opposition, and that's the fourth time in a row in the third round, and then it tends to affect their league form, and it's a trend for Leeds. And sadly, that's where fans are thinking, "Wow, let's just not see the wheels come off just at the moment."
Mm. And what's that put down to?
Well, I mean, the defeat at Crawley, I would say, would be down to the changes he made at half time. Definitely weakened the side, and I think he was so rigid in what he wanted to do that day was to give Liam Cooper, who's coming back from injury, the captain 45 minutes, which he did. But when he took the spine of the team out at half-time, they just couldn't cope with, against a promotion-chasing lower-league side. Mm. And it's men's football, and when you're thrown at academy lads who are technically very good at it, they've got to adapt a little bit and find that little bit extra, I think. And it didn't happen, to be fair. And I felt sorry for Jack Jenkins and Sam Greenwood and players like that came on and, you know, they just didn't really cope with the circumstances. Although, you have to say that blame wasn't put down on the younger players by Bielsa. But ultimately, it was a good side that was put out that first 11 that day, and it didn't happen. And Leeds fans just found it really disappointing. You know, they've not been in a quarter final for, since 2003. So that was one of the issues. And then the other day against Brighton, I'd say that it was the lack of creative chances and also on a difficult surface at Elland Road, which he won't blame. But I think it is affecting, or certainly showing signs that it would affect the way that they play, which is a beautiful passing game, as you know.
Yeah. They're a joy to watch, you know, and I think everybody still has faith in Bielsa. John Giles is a regular on this show still, and you know, you'll know all about. And he was saying the other night, you know, if Bielsa had the Man United players, he'd win the league. You know, some of the stuff he sees from Bielsa is really top class. The thing which strikes me about Bielsa is he's honest. Now, ironically, I first really felt this in the fallout from Spygate, which is an odd thing to say, but I thought he was very honest about that. And even after the Old Trafford result, he defended the team at length. And I thought, I believe him. You know, I feel like he's been really honest here. And so it would cause Leeds fans a slight degree of worry when Bielsa comes out after this most recent defeat to Brighton, hot on the heels of that FA Cup defeat, and says, this one causes me worry. You know, he's openly saying that I'm seeing things here in his brilliant way that worry him. And, you know, 12th is okay. They've got a bit of breathing room, but you don't want to linger.
No, you don't. And the next game for Leeds is, they were meant to play tonight against Southampton. They've got Newcastle away, who, as you quite rightly said, Joe, they battered them at Elland Road. It was a, you know, I know Newcastle got a couple of goals, but it was a 5-2 going on 6 or 7. Now, for me, if they've got to beat Newcastle. With Newcastle in free fall, I think they're in massive danger of going down. So faith in Bielsa is there. It's just, I think he's been criticised more in the last few weeks than I've really noticed in the past. I mean, they've had wobbles each season, Joe. Don't forget, you know, they've had and long sort of wobbles, if you like, which threatened promotion last season for a little while before they really got it together with about 6 games before the lockdown came and the stop in proceedings. So there is faith, and he's not going to change. So you know that.
Yeah.
You know, we've spoken about that before. This is his way.
Yeah, and of course, and it's what makes him so compelling. Is there a specific criticism of him, or is it just general mutterings?
It was specific about the Crawley was what he did at halftime. That was the big criticism. Also, I mean, people then will look at selection and think, oh, you know, Kike Casilla's been in goal as well. I mean, he had a nightmare that game, there's no doubt about it, although he's been defended and continues to be defended by Bielsa, you know, ever since. So selection's been a bit of an issue, but he's got so much credit, Joe. He's 120 games in, win ratio, you know, it's superb. It's above 50%. He's achieved, let's not forget, he's achieved something that nobody had done in 16 years at Leeds. And as you say, and John Giles is absolutely correct here, the coaching of these players to a level that nobody expected of them is almost incomparable. I've never seen coaching to this level. So the faith is there, but that doesn't mean that there can't be genuine criticism. And the great thing with him, Joe, is that he will either defend it, because he'll listen to it, and he'll either come back with a retort and lay it all out there for you in a lengthy press conference pre-match.
Yeah.
And he does respect everybody's opinion on that, if you like. And he has the decency to engage you on it as well, which is, a lot of managers won't do it. They think you're impinging on them.
Enjoy it while you can, Adam. It won't last when the next guy's in. Stay with us a moment, because there's been a big goal at Craven Cottage. Joe Rawson has the details.
Fulham 1, Manchester United 2. Scott Parker's side started this second half well, but they failed to make their pressure pay, and United had made them pay at the other end. A fantastic goal from Paul Pogba, who controlled the ball out of the sky over on the right-hand side, took it inside two Fulham defenders up to the edge of the area, and then curled the ball past the dive of Areola into the right-hand side. It's Fulham 1, Manchester United 2.
It was a brilliant goal. It was a brilliant goal. It was a really, really brilliant goal. He takes a lot of sticks. You're kind of happy for him sometimes when it works out. Adam. The Karen Carney business. There's a gazillion views on all this. Your sense of the club and how it handled it, and the wider interpretation of what went on. She's obviously shut down her Twitter account. Now, this is former English international Karen Carney, who had some criticism of Leeds, or some worries for Leeds, and she was making the point, I think people are fairly familiar with this story, but in short, she was making the point on Amazon Prime that, you know, maybe COVID had saved them a little bit last season in terms of giving them a rest. We've often talked about Leeds' hard running, and then, the point was made that they had won 6 and drawn 1 of their 9 fixtures before lockdown, so hardly in crisis before lockdown arrived. And Leeds United retweeted this, and the pile-on ensued, and then the various opinions were thrown in, be it, well, this is treating her like a male pundit, and this is, you know, this is equality, this is what happens if you're a pundit, and others saying, look, female pundits are trying to make their way in the game, and you invite a pile on like that on social media, and it gets nasty, and it did get nasty. So your sense of it all, Adam, your thoughts on it?
Well, firstly, I think anybody at the club was right to call out what was incorrect, if you want to call it journalism or lazy punditry, is what people have thrown at it. And I think in that sense, they do call out those pundits are doing. It's not just Karen that's done that there. You know, Tim Sherwood's done it. I think Robbie Savage has been guilty of it. So, but in those instances, have they retweeted a video in the same way on their official website? And I think that is the point where once you do that, you are going to, you're using an official platform and you are, in a sense, inviting that sort of response. Now, they're not responsible in that sense for the content, which was horrendous towards Karen at times. And you have to remember also that this is a person who suffered from mental health quite openly issues, you know, sort of 3, 4, 5 years ago, I think it was mentioned in particular. So what she said was incorrect. It might have come out wrong, but to say that they'd gone up because of COVID was just not right at all. I think the method in which they've used to sort of highlight this was wrong, but I think there's been a policy at the club, and we felt, I think certainly for some time as a press corps, that they've skirted very close to making a mistake, which I think it was, to do this, to be quite honest. It was defended very quickly by the owner, who was sort of, I think, you know, he does use social media sometimes and maybe a little bit too quickly, where he defended the actions of the club. And I get the sentiment, but I just think it was the wrong way to go about it. So, and I think privately, the club regretted that it was done, and I think they'd see a change. They want to be, in a social media sense, more like a Roma, who are sort of well-known for a lot of their social media sort of output, really, if you like, and do a lot of good. They can be very funny at times, Leeds, but I think they got this one wrong, to be quite honest. And going forward, as I understand it, you know, they were trying to sort of build bridges with Karen Carney. And I think the irony here as well, Joe, is that, you know, you look at Patrick Bamford, somebody who's suffered a lot of social media abuse, particularly over the last couple of seasons, and now is obviously proverbially sticking two fingers up at all his critics. You know, he's gone through that, and they've been aware of that. And I understand that Patrick has going to speak to Karen, and they're trying to sort of, you know, smooth the waters there's a responsibility from the club to be careful, and I think they got this one wrong. That's my opinion.
What's a good season for Leeds then, Adam?
Well, I think for me, it was comfortable 15th. That was my prediction, and I'm going to stick with that. I think right now, Joe, I think you're bang on. You know, they're sitting, 12th in the table today. And I think, you know, if they were to finish in that middle bracket, that'd be superb. Yeah. Because honestly, I mean, I never, the aim was not to gurgle around the plug hole. That was from the chief executive's mouth, Angus Kinnear. And you know that the way they play, especially when the season gets tighter for a lot of teams that are in search of either trying to stay up or trying to get into the European places, Leeds' way will scare the life out of them, and any side that shows nerves, Leeds will overcome, I think. So I think you might see even the better of Leeds to come this season. So right now, well ahead of schedule, well ahead. And I think they've beaten 5 of the bottom 6. If they'd beaten Brighton, I really think, honestly, Joe, if they'd moved on to, you know, the 26 points and beat all the bottom 6 ones, you're thinking, well, they're just a few draws and a couple of wins away from doing it. There's a little sense they could get dragged back in, you know. I mean, I know Fulham are behind tonight, but there's said that maybe one or two might pick up, but I just don't see them giving up that many points, to be quite honest, even if they had a horrendous time. I don't see them strengthening big time. I think you're going to look at that in the summer, Joe, to be quite honest. So for me, where they're sat right now, if they can maintain that, that is superb. They are ahead of it for me. And in general, the faith in Bielsa is so strong that you know that they'll see through these relatively choppy times.
And a last one then, because obviously you're far more familiar with Bielsa in the longer term than us. Premier League Bielsa, is he enjoying it as much? Does he look happy in himself? Is he, you know, planning for seasons ahead, or do we ever know?
Well, I suppose in essence, he's planned from the beginning because of the amount of sort of roots he's put down in terms of, you know, a coaching structure, if you like, a philosophy at the club, the way that they've developed things, that the changes, the infrastructure changes at the training ground, and also the owners followed up with some stuff at the ground as well, and there's stuff to be done there too. I think whether he was to go in the summer or not, I think there's a legacy for the long term. There was a plan, certainly. Is he enjoying it? It's really weird, actually, because when you see him pre-match, he can do massively long sort of press conferences with us, even though it's by the Zoom and what have you, and he goes into detail and he looks very comfortable and quite happy. Post-match, you can see he's trying to get out as quickly as possible because he's got so many more commitments to do. They're the only times that we see him, but I don't really see a change in him from last year or the year before. There are certain issues that really bite him, and he wants to come out and defend things. Like, he's defended Kiko Casilla to the hilt in terms of his confidence in him, despite him having a mare. I know there's other issues there for a lot of fans with Kiko over the racism issue, whether he should be at the club or not. And this will not go away until that's until either he does, to be honest. But in terms of football ability, that's a big issue right now. And he's come out and defended that to the hilt, defended him to the hilt, while there is the unexplained absence of Ilan Meslier. The club aren't saying anything about COVID with their players since Rodrigo announced that he had it in November. But I think it's fair to say there's been an issue with one or two players. So Kiko's played lately. So when it's stuff like that and players are coming under massive criticism or he's coming under criticism, he will come out and defend things when he feels the need to as well. But in general, I don't see any change in him other than he's managed to lift the side mid-table of the Premier League, which is quite astounding, really.
Very good. Listen, always good to have you on. Adam Pope of BBC Leeds. Cheers, Adam.
Cheers now, Joe.
Appreciate it. So, 78 minutes in the clock. Fulham 1, Manchester
Football
2, very late.
On Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. Fueling the mischief in the beautiful game. Gamble responsibly. See Dunlewy.net.
The OTB Podcast Network. With Green Farm on the go. Snack smart with 100% natural, protein-powered chicken bites.